So today I want to talk about some recent work that I've done on stochastic inflation and some applications to some model of inflation where we can get some interesting, cool new results. So here's the outline of my talk. First, I'm going to give some heuristic motivation for what stochastic inflation is and what it tries to do. And then I'm going to try to motivate the recursive method that I've proposed to calculate inflationary predictions. And then to understand why this is something that makes sense, then I'm going to go and look at the microphysics of how stochastic inflation emerges. And so I'm going to go look at the in-in formalism and how we can derive the stochastic equations of motion from there. Then I'm going to move on to some applications to some concrete model of the recursive method to get some new results. Okay, so first things first. We're interested in cosmology, and usually when we do cosmology, we work with the FRW metric. So this is what I've written down here in the cosmic time and conformal time. So with the FRW metric, the important parameter is the scale factor A. That's the thing that allows you to relate your co-meeting coordinates to the physical distances between stuff. So basically, physical co-moving coordinates don't change with time, but then the physical distances change according to A. They scale with A. Two important parameters to define here are H, so the Hubble parameter, which tells you how A is changing with time. And here I've used the first Freeman equation to relate it to the energy density in the universe. So basically the amount of stuff in the universe tells A how it changes with time. And another important thing to define is the dissolution parameter Q, which is basically it tells you how H is changing with time. So basically, just to get some intuition for what this is, if you have a cosmological, pure cosmological constant that dominates the energy density, then rho is a constant, so H is a constant, and Q is minus one. Okay, so now that I've defined those things, I can tell you what inflation is. Inflation is defined to be a phase of accelerated expansion where H is larger than zero, and Q is between minus one and zero. So the minus one, the lower bound here, is just from the null energy condition. So then if we have those conditions satisfied, then the physical distances are going to be growing quasi-exponentially. Okay, so that's it. So basically, that's what inflation is. So now the next question is, how do we get inflation to happen? So the usual way we do that is through slow roll inflation. So what slow roll inflation is when you have a quantum scalar field that has a zero mode that dominates the energy density of the universe. And that zero mode is slowly rolling down the slope of a really flat potential. So that zero mode is going to obey the Klein-Gödel equation, and then because it dominates the energy density of the universe, it's going to be the thing that goes into H, so it has the kinetic energy and then its potential energy. And it's a zero mode, so it's homogeneous, that's why there's no gradient term here. So if we assume that the quantum field is dominated by its zero mode and that it's rolling really slowly, then we can neglect the kinetic energy, so H is basically just V, so it's a constant, and so you can solve for A, and then you get that A is approximately exponential, so you get that inflation is happening. Okay, so the picture that I've just described relies on the fact that I have my full scalar field that I split into a zero mode and some small quantum fluctuations on top of it. So the zero mode is the thing that is classical and is the thing that provides for the background. And because it's homogeneous, that's the thing that's going to drive the accelerated expansion. On the other side, I have the small quantum fluctuations that are sort of small perturbations on top of that. And they're the thing that are going to give rise to all the structure that we observe in the universe today. So the way this works is that during inflation, deep inside the Hubble horizon, you have vacuum fluctuations inside the Hubble horizon. And as the space is expanding, this fluctuation gets stretched. They cross the Hubble horizon where they freeze out, they get squeezed, they classicalize, and then they become classical density perturbations. So this is continuously happening during inflation, so that by the end of inflation, I have a whole spectrum of these fluctuations outside of the Hubble horizon. And then after inflation, this spectrum is slowly going to re-enter the Hubble horizon and then source the density fluctuations that we observe in the CMB, and then later on, like all structure formation and all that. So, okay, so the question that you might be tempted to ask at this point is, this split always a good split? So basically, if inflation lasts long enough, can't it happen that I have enough of those like density fluctuations that have some energy density outside of the Hubble horizon that they give a significant contribution to the background, so that what I thought was the background is not actually the right thing? So basically, that's the question of back reaction. And one possible way of addressing this question is to realize that the only thing that we really care about in inflation is the stuff that's classical. So it's the background, the zero mode basically, plus all of those quantum fluctuations that have become classical outside of the Hubble horizon. The quantum part of the theory inside of the Hubble horizon, we don't really care about because that's not something that's observable for us. So if we could just integrate that part out by sort of coarse graining over a size of the Hubble horizon, then we end up with some sort of like effective classical theory that only has the part of the theory that we care about. So that's sort of the idea here. So of course, this is going to be something a little bit complicated because as I just described, during inflation, you constantly have some modes that are exiting the Hubble horizon and join the sort of effective classical theory. So my effective classical theory is going to have a source term that's going to be sort of represented by some noise that represents those modes sort of joining my coarse grain theory. And what stochastic inflation is exactly the way of performing that averaging so that you end up with that noise in a consistent way, sourcing your effective classical theory.
So just to check, by the, you're going to assume that whatever was going on there has some type of stochastic distribution. That's one of the base assumptions here, or are you going to derive this?
Sorry?
So are you assuming that there's some kind of stochastic distribution for these modes coming out, or
in
are you going to derive
this?
Well, when you say noise, that's normally what I interpret. Yeah.
So you mean the PDF for the noise, or you mean the fact that it's noise?
Well, why is it calling it noise?
It means the distribution.
Yeah.
No, I'm going to derive a PDF.
Okay.
So it's noise because modes have, so I'm going to explain that a bit later, but the reason why it's noise is because every mode has a random phase, so when it joins the coarse grain theory, it sort of freezes with a random amplitude. So that's the reason why it's noise. But then the variation, so the standard deviation for that amplitude, you can derive. And if it's Gaussian or not, you can derive. Does that answer your question?
I'll ask again.
Okay. all right, so at this point, you might be tempted to ask me, why does this even matter? I mean, this effect might be real, but maybe it's just so small that we don't care about it at all. So I'm calculating something that's there, but that's completely not important. But actually, there are some cases where we know that this effect comes to dominate the dynamics during inflation. For example, if you have your scalar field that's rolling over really small values in field space, it might be that its evolution is dominated by its quantum dispersion. So that's what happens at the end of hybrid inflation, where you know the potential becomes tachyonic and then you sort of roll one way or the other. That's dominated by the quantum dispersion. I'm going to talk about that later. And also like in sort of hilltop models of inflation, where you start at the top of the potential and it's quantum fluctuation that drives you to like fall off. So that sort of examples. And then another example is in eternal inflation, where we know that it has to be the case that the classical solution becomes completely wrong and because dominated, becomes dominated by sort of quantum corrections. But more generally, it's actually a really like powerful non-perturbative method because it constantly renormalizes the background to incorporate incoming modes that come from the quantum sector of the theory. So for example, like, and then so we end up expanding around a background that's sort of constantly being renormalized. So H in your theory, H of T becomes like constantly the physical H of T. So it's sort of a, in that sense, it's sort of a powerful non-perturbative method.
Sarah, why don't they just obviously matter because those are the perturbations that make the world move
Well, they matter because they're perturbations, but you like it's a matter of what you expand around. Like it's just a matter of what you of what you expand around.
Yeah, but cosmology is about the study of these perturbations, right?
Well, if you're happy that it's important, I don't need to convince you then.
Okay.
It's
more pedagogically designed, but yeah.
Yeah, sorry, it's like it means to be flexible. I'm sorry. All right. So now I've told you sort of what stochastic inflation tries to do. I'm going to derive it in a heuristic way from the equations of motion. I can skip straight away to the more hardcore stuff if this is too basic.
Ignore the obnoxious people.
So, all right, so I'm going to do it for two scalar fields, not because two is special, but just because I want to show that there's nothing magic that happens when you have many scalar fields. It's sort of trivial to generalize to more scalar fields than that. So the first thing that we do is that we split the full quantum field into a coarse grain part and a quantum part. So the coarse grain part is going to be like var phi and chi, and these are the modes that have wavelengths that are larger than the somewhat like size of the Hubble horizon. And the quantum part of the field are these two, and they have physical wavelengths inside of the Hubble horizon. So to make that more explicit, I can expand the quantum part of my field into creation annihilation operator. So this part in bracket here is just the standard thing that you get when you do that in sort of shifting curve space time. So basically, the phi k and the psi k are the linearized mode function, and the a dagger, b dagger are just creation annihilation operators. So the thing that's different here is the window function here, the wh. So that function is the thing that is going to project in the quantum part of the field only those modes that are inside the Hubble horizon. So, yes? And then the sort of the most obvious and simplest trace you can think of for that window function is sort of a theta function around the Hubble horizon. And here, the epsilon parameter is some sort of ignorance parameter, because I want to make sure that in my coarse grain theory, I only include modes that have had time to go through the classicalization process, so that it's really a classical theory. So this choice of window function is also the simplest one you can make, because the coarse grain stochastic processes that you end up with at the end of the day are going to be Markovian, so it means that they don't have any memory, which is sort of a lot simpler. But it's not a very physical choice of window function, because what we're trying to do here is to coarse grain over a physical volume of the Hubble size. But the Fourier transform of a sharp cutoff in k-space is not really something that's super local in space. So you're going to end up with some spurious, like long-scale correlations. So to make a more physical choice, there's a bunch of criteria. You can choose a smooth window function, and then it has to satisfy a bunch of criteria, like it has to decay faster than r to the minus 6 and stuff like that. But I don't want to get involved into those details here for the purpose of this talk, so I'm just going to leave the window function implicit. But to get some intuition for what's going on, it's really useful to think about the window function. So the sharp cutoff in k-space is really helpful to get some intuition.
Do you have some argument that the end result you're going to have is going to be independent of what choice of this window
function? Yeah, you can show it. In this paper, you really show it, that if you get a smooth window function that satisfies like a bunch of those criteria that I was mentioning, the result that you get is independent of the coarse graining radius. And at the end of the day, you can check that your answer, if you choose that epsilon to be small enough, so that epsilon has to be smaller than one, right? Because you want to coarse grain over a radius that's larger than the Hubble horizon. But if you choose it to be small enough, the result is sort of a series in log of that epsilon. And if you get a loop expansion, it's just like saying that so the dependence on that is at the next order in perturbation theory. So it's a log series. So it's kind of sensible. Does that answer your question? Okay. So now that we have that split, that's clear between the coarse grain field and the quantum field, I can plug these back into, So I can plug them back into my Klein-Gordon equation, and then I can collect together the part of it that's linear in my quantum field. So that's what I've done here in the bracket. So if I plug in the extension into creation annihilation operator that I wrote down the previous page, I'm going to end up with a part of it that's just the linearized equation, linearized mode function equation of motion. And because they have to satisfy their own equation of motion, that part is just going to be zero. But there's also going to be a residual part, because in my window function, I have some time dependence. So every time that there's a time derivative from here that acts on the window function, I'm going to get a non-zero term. So if I just do that replacement, I'm left with some leftover source here. Now I've subtracted the equation of motion. And so this is the thing that's going to represent the noise. So I can just work out very easily how to write this in terms of like three noise terms. So it's sort of trivial algebra to derive what those three these noise terms are in terms of the creation annihilation operator. And as advertised, they both depend on at least one time derivative of the window function. So if you think of the window function as a theta function, that becomes a delta function. So this is really picking out the one mode at every time that is crossing the Hubble horizon and joining the effective theory. So so the picture is really like I have this effective theory, and every time it's getting kicked by a noise that represents a mode that's crossing the Hubble horizon. Make sense? Yeah? All right. So if I write down now my two Klein-Gordon equations for my two fields, in the first line of these equations, I have managed to get rid of all my quantum fields, I only have classical stuff. And in the second line of those two equations, I have the leftover quantum field that I have not managed to get rid of yet. So actually, at this point, because these terms all represent mode coupling, they're all going to be slower suppressed. So I'm going to neglect them for now. But I'm going to come back to how you actually include them in terms of extra noise terms later on in the talk. So we get rid of them. And now we managed to get rid of anything that was quantum in this equation. So these are like now two classical equations of motion that are sourced by some noise terms. And if I just work out more of the details of the noise terms, it turns out that the last two terms, this one and this one on both equations, are actually also slower suppressed, so I can just neglect them for now. So what I end up with is a system of Langevin equations that are sourced by random Gaussian noise terms. And so the reason why it's noise is, as I said before, it's because it's every mode has a random phase. So when it crosses the Hubble horizon, it has a random, it kicks the background with a random amplitude that's given with an RMS that's given by the linearized mode function. And it's Gaussian because, as I wrote on the previous slide, the noise is given in terms of the linearized mode function, and that obeys a linear equation of motion, so it's Gaussian. So I know that's like, maybe you're not super convinced by that because it's like super heuristic, but I'm going to show how you can actually properly derive that. Okay, so now if I want to completely define the system, I have to tell you how to calculate the noise. So in order to know the noise, I have to solve the linearized mode function equation of motion, which are these two equations here. So now we see that these equations, they depend on the coarse grain theory through this time-dependent mass here, potentially, and through this like term here. So I end up with two systems, a classical one and a quantum one. So and they both depend on each other. The classical system depends on the quantum system through the noise, and the quantum system depends on the classical system through the time-dependent mass. So in order to solve them consistently, I have to solve both of them to the same order, both in slow roll and in h-bar. So that sort of motivates a recursive method to do that. Okay, so the recursive method that I've been working with is that, like, step number one, you just start with, you want to check to get the noise for free massless field in pure de-Sitter space, so that's the zero-th order and slower approximation. So that's sort of the standard result that you get to get this two-point function for the noise. And I can use that to source the equations of motion for the coarse grain field. That's also sort of the standard equation. And then the only thing that I've done here is that I've changed the time variable to the number of e-folds. What that does is that the stochastic processes that I end up with at the end of the day are the Newtonov variables, so they're gauge dependent, which is a good thing. So if I solve this equation, these equations of motion, I end up with a solution that's valid to leading order in slow roll and to leading order in h-bar. And now I'm not solving for one realization of the background because these are stochastic processes, these are Langevin equations. So I'm gonna end up solving for the probability density function for these processes over many realizations. So I can find the moments of their distribution, like their mean, their standard deviation, there's like, so these are the quantities that I'm gonna be solving for. So from the point of view of mode sitting inside of the Hubble horizon, this is what acts as a background. It's gonna be one realization of that process for every different like sort of patch. So if we want to know how the mode functions are gonna be evolving in that background, we can take a representative, as an approximation, this is just an approximation, but we can pick a representative realization of those backgrounds and then evolve the mode function on that solution. So to do that, we can just take, in the linearized mode function, we can just take all the occurrences of the background fields, the coarse grain fields, and just replace them by their moment that we get from the PDF that we solved for the previous step. And then we expand the linearized mode function to leading order in slow roll, and we get a noise that's valid to leading order in slow roll, which isn't what we had before.
So are we evaluating this at every time step, or this is like the moment?
No, so you do it for like every time, and then you plug it to the next step, and then you do it for every time, and plug it to the next. It's just like the recursion. So this is sort of the idea. And then once you get the corrected noise, you can feed that back into your Langevin equation, and then you can solve once again for the coarse grain system, but now your solution is valid sort of to next to leading order. And so you can solve for quantities that depend both on h bar, and on slower parameters, such as the tilt of the potential. And then you can keep on going until you've reached the required level of accuracy.
How do you account for the dependence on initial conditions? So do you, what do you assume for the initial conditions?
That's
to
exactly.
Your
So you're always linear in the perturbation. The equation is always linear in the perturbations. Is that right?
So it's because okay. So this is sort of the heuristic hand wavy thing. So you can. I'm going to show you how it actually comes about. So it's because it's a linearized equation of motion, because the real thing that it is the propagator for those fields.
Yeah.
So you can solve for the propagator, and then if you get the nonlinear, you know, you can get loop corrections to that, and then it's going to be a non-Gaussian noise.
Yeah, but when you say you compute corrections, the expansion you're talking about is just the slow roll expansion, or there you're also computing loop correction?
I'm also computing loop correction.
Okay.
So it's a two-parameter expansion. It's an expansion in slow roll.
Yeah.
And in loops.
I'm surprised that you can do loops with this stochastic.
Yeah, I'm going to show you how it comes about, like right now. Okay, so to understand why this makes sense, you have to go and look at the microphysics of like how this comes about and what is it that by coarse graining an equation of motion it makes sense to get an effective theory. So to understand how this works, it's really useful to use the fact that inflation is really similar to quantum Brownian motion. It's actually like kind of the same thing. And so that means that we're going to be using similar techniques. So we're going to be working with the in-in formalism. So I don't know if how familiar people are here with the in-in formalism. Yeah. So that's, I don't know. Grad students familiar with the in-in formalism? Okay. So I had some sort of like small review of what it is, but sort of the comparison between like in-out and like in-in, but like, I guess, I don't know. Then the in-out, you're trying to calculate the S matrix elements. So you start with like an asymptotic state in the past, and you go to an asymptotic state in the future, and then you calculate transition amplitudes, and you have one particle that are defined in the past and in the future. Whereas in the in-in formalism, what you're calculating is the expectation values of operator at some finite time t naught, and you have only asymptotic states defined in the past. So the contour that you're working with looks like something like this. So you start like in the past, and the like infinite past where you have your initial state, in the forward part of the contour, your operators are time ordered, and then at t naught, you evaluate your operators. The expectation value of your operators, and then you go back, and then operators are anti-time ordered, like in the other branch of the contour. So, okay, so, and then yes. So now the next thing that we do, we take our fields, and we do the same split as what we did before. So we split them between a coarse grain part and a quantum part with the same type of split. But then we also have to further split all those fields between the part that lives on the upper branch of the contour and the part that lives on the lower branch of the contour, so that for each field, I end up with four fields. So because I have two scalar fields, now I have eight fields to work with. And I put them in the bunch of his vacuum initially, just because it's going to make my life so much easier at the end of the day. So what we do here is then the goal is to integrate out. So I'm just using Bath and system for like the quantum part and the coarse grain part, just because that's sort of the usual terminology when you're doing quantum binary. So the Bath is the stuff that we want to integrate out, so the stuff that's like the quantum mode, and the system is the thing that we're interested in, so it's the coarse grain system. So what we want to do basically is just integrate out the Bath. So it's really similar in philosophy than what you do when you do Wilsonian renormalization. You just want to integrate out some field and get some effective potential for the rest of your fields. So because I made a clever choice of initial state, the bunch of his vacuum, my density matrix initially factorizes between my Bath and my system. So it means that, yeah.
Why is that?
What?
Why is that
physical? Because they don't make their stuff mixed, like every mode is independent. Like, they just factorize nicely.
Because the theory is free. So
yeah.
Mode by mode, the wave function is a product. That was one of the things I was wondering about with the nonlinearities, but she's going to explain it to us, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, so because of that, once I've integrated out my field, I can actually write down a sort of a functional representation for the time evolution operator of my system field. So if I can basically write on an effective action like that. And here, so if I split my action into like the system fields and the Bath fields, I'm going to have terms in the action that only depend on the system fields, terms in the action that mix the system and the Bath fields, and terms in the action that are only Bath fields. So the part of the action that only has system field, I just keep like here like this. So this is the part that lives on the upper branch of the contour, and this is the part that lives on the lower branch of the contour. And the minus sign is just because I flipped the boundaries of integration to have only like sort of something that goes forward in time. And then all the other terms are part of this S functional here. So this S functional is called the influence functional, and it's something that's really non-trivial in general. So it's something that's like sort of depend on the time history and mixes the lower and the like the upper and the lower part of the contour in an irreducible way. So usually it's really non-trivial, but in some very simple cases, you can actually write it down explicitly. So if we make some assumption for what potentials we have, like a really simple assumption that like these are free fields with just a mass, I can write it down explicitly. So here I've done some vector definition for my fields because like otherwise it takes forever to write down. But it's because like there's the upper branch of the contour and the lower branch of the contour, so I can write that in vector form. And then my Klein-Gödel operator are just like Klein-Gödel operator matrices with like the upper branch and the lower branch of the contour. So it's just sort of a compact way of writing things out. And so I get basically for every field, I get the part of the action that depends only on the bath and the mix term between the bath and the system for both of my fields. And then you can write that as sort of an influence action, just like notation. Okay, so now just some remark. In flat space, usually the cross term, the term that's linear in the bath field, we would set it to zero to make sure that the linearized mode function satisfy their own equation of motion, sort of like the tadpole method. But here, it's a little bit different because we also have the window function that is time dependent. So just as before, every time there's a time derivative that acts on the window function, it's going to give rise to a non-zero term. So it's actually not vanishing that linear term. So that's why I kept it up there. So yeah, and then like as before, this is exactly the terms that are going to represent modes like leaving the bath and joining my system. And if I assume, if I think of the window function as sort of a sharp cutoff in k-space, that's the only overlap that this system has with the bath. Otherwise, they would evolve completely independently. Okay, so this said, then that my like influence functional was just a Gaussian thing. So I can just integrate it. I can just anchor it over the bath. And then the answer that I get once I'm done is this. So for every field, there are two terms. And they depend on the real and imaginary parts, basically, like the real part of some kernel and the imaginary part of some kernel. And this kernel really looks like a propagator, but then there's some projection operator that acts on my linearized mode function. So, and that projection operator has at least one derivative of the window function, like all the time. So this is doing exactly what we expected it to do. It's just projecting the one mode that's leaving the horizon at every time and making it an effective system. Okay. All right, and then if you look at that, like I've also redefined some fields. So I had this vector of fields, like the upper element was the upper branch of the contour and the other element was the lower branch of the contour. So I've just rotated that vector by 45 degrees to define the classical and the quantum fields. It's just like notation. It's called the classical field because it's sort of the part of the field that doesn't interfere between the upper branch of the contour and the lower branch of the contour. And the other one's called the quantum field because it's a part of the fields that interfere between the upper branch and the lower branch of the contour. So yeah, this is just the definition here of the new vectors. And so that's what I get. And if you stare long enough at this influence action, you can realize something odd about it, which is that it has a real term and an imaginary term. And the reason for that is that this is the fluctuation dissipation theorem. So as I just said, you have a real and an imaginary term in the influence action. So the real term represents dissipation and the imaginary term represents noise. So let's start by the real term. So the real term is proportional to the imaginary part of the kernel. And it's dissipation because if you work out the information that it has in the equation of motion for the classical part of the field, it's going to give rise to, so its antisymmetric part is going to give rise to a term that's non-local and proportional to the time derivative of the classical part of the field. So that means friction in the equation of motion. So friction means dissipation. So in the case where this friction is subdominant compared to the Hubble friction, we get slower inflation. And in the case where this friction term dominates over the Hubble friction, we get warm inflation, which is sort of a cool sort of relationship between warm inflation and slower inflation. But for the rest of the talk, I'm only interested in slower inflation, so I'm going to neglect this term from now on. I just wanted to point it out. Okay, so the term that we're mostly interested in is the noise term. So that's the part that's proportional to the real part of the kernel. And it gives rise to an imaginary term in the Euclidean spectrum. So to properly interpret that term, we have to see it as a weighted average over noise configurations, over like a real noise term. And so to see it properly, it's easier to reintroduce that noise explicitly in the action in a way that I'm going to show you in 1 second. But for now, I just want to point out that this is the fluctuation dissipation theorem, because what it says is that noise and dissipation always come together because they come from the same fundamental degrees of freedom. And this is exactly what we have here. They show up as the real and imaginary part of the same thing. And if you further look at the ratio of those two things, you end up with being able to, like, you end up being able to define a temperature that is kind of really close to the Sitter-Hawking temperature, and with some corrections that are proportional to Slorol. So it's kind of a neat thing. All right, so let's reintroduce that noise term. So if I was gonna define two noises per field, and get them to have some like probability density function that's given like that, basically just a Gaussian PDF with something that's kind of complicated, but basically it's just a projected like propagator thing. And then I was gonna define this effective action. The terms that are, okay, so it's kind of like, it's kind of hard to see it, but once you see it, it's like really obvious. So you have the term, so you have the PDF here that is bilinear in both noise terms, and you have the linear terms in the noises. So if you were going to integrate out those noises, you would end up with exactly the term from the influence action that I had before, the imaginary term, because these are real fields, so they don't have an I here, whereas those are part of the action, so they have an I. That's why it's imaginary in the action. So, so this is the noise part of the influence action. And then for the rest of my effective action, it just comes from the part of the action that only had system fields. And I've just rewritten them in terms of quantum and classical fields. So that's my effective action for this theory. And now I want to do some, take the classical limit of this effective action. So I'm going to reintroduce powers of h-bar in the quantum field. So every time I have a quantum field, I'm going to rescale it with like h-bar. And I expand in powers of h-bar, and I can get the classical equations of motion by taking this variational derivative with respect to the quantum fields and setting the quantum field to zero. Because we know that for real, there's only one time, so the upper branch and the lower branch of the contour should be like exactly the same thing. So the quantum field should be zero. So that gives me the classical limit. And I end up with my two Langevin equations, which are exactly the same thing as what I had before, but if I make some like minor kind of trivial noise redefinition. So it works. And now, as before, to find what the noise terms are, I need to know what the BAT propagators are. So I need to solve for the linearized mode function equations of motion. So I need to solve this system. So we indeed end up with two systems that are dependent on each other. So that sort of motivates the recursive method that I was talking about. So now, if you wanted to have sort of more complicated potentials that are not just free with some massive field, you can define pretty easily a perturbation expansion, like a loop expansion from this formalism. So what you do is sort of the standard thing. You introduce two currents, one per branch of the contour, and then you tail expand your potential and you integrate it order by order in the BAT field. All right. So there's just some minor like technical choices that you have to make, but actually like it's just that it makes life easier if you consider terms like that to be part of the BAT propagator, because then the thing that you have to solve for is actually the linearized mode function. So you get less noise terms and it's just simpler. But actually it's equivalent to like choosing whatever you want, like just putting that as part of the interactions and getting just the free propagator as a propagator. You can show it's exactly the same thing. So all right, and then for every loop correction that we include, we get an extra noise term and an extra dissipation term and a mass renormalization term. So if I just show you a little bit what diagrams look like. So for example, if I choose like a potential that looks like, I don't know, something like that, then every time I have, so the leading order noise that we just calculated, like the free thing, was like diagrams that look like this. So sort of just the diagrams that come from m squared, phi squared. So it's sort of, they look weird, but that's the thing that gives rise to the noise, because it doesn't really have a loop. So it's sort of a, but then if I include interactions and terms in the action that have only fields, like bath fields, they're going to give loop correction to the bath propagator. So they're going to give rise, so for example, this term here has only bath fields, so it's going to correct my bath propagator like that. And so that's going to make the noise non-Gaussian, but it's still the same noise term. Whereas if I have terms that have both powers of the bath and the system, they correct the influence that the bath has on the system, and this is going to give rise to like diagrams that look like this or like that, and those are going to give rise to new noise terms in the equation of motion. A new noise term, a new dissipation term, and a mass renormalization term.
So yeah. The middle one is that it gives rise to a noise that's not Gaussian, but it has the same term in the equations of motion, so that just means the statistics of that.
Is there any difference? Can you not
that,
Gaussian? Yeah.
And a variable, I guess, in the equations of motion.
Yeah. So just the statistics of the noise that's going to change. Yeah. So you can get corrections to this. So that's how we define sort of the loop extension. Does that answer your question? Yeah, okay.
So, I mean, it seems like you're still just doing the loops in the quantum field theory, sort of taking the results and reinterpreting them. Is that?
Yeah, so it's the same thing. It's just that I'm not fixing the background and expanding around that background.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what you do anyway, right? I mean, you pick a gauge and.
No, but you expand around as like a fixed background. So you can, it's the same thing. You would just like, if you were going to do like the usual NN formalism for like in the effective theory of inflation, the only thing that you have to do is you want to get the actual background and subtract the tadpole. I mean, that's the, and then you would get the same answer. It's the same thing. It's just that it's simpler like that. It just comes out naturally. You don't need to work hard to calculate like what the subtraction is for the tadpole.
Well, but I mean, it looks like you're just computing the same diagrams. I guess that's what I'm a little confused.
It's the same theory.
Yeah. So, but then why are we dressing it up in this stochastic language? I guess that's the thing I haven't quite understood yet. I mean, it's just quantum field theory. We can just do the calculations. So, what's the? I mean, what are we gaining?
Well, so you don't have. So I guess you just gain that your background is straight. Like, it's just about having the proper background to expand around, really.
You don't get the background.
And then the back correction is already taken care of. So all the classical back correction is already taken care of. And then
I was assuming that one of your scalars I should interpret as symmetric perturbation or something.
Well, in this case, it's like the same thing, right? There's only like the scalar and the, like the scalar metric perturbation are the same thing. Like there's.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not like you don't, it's not like you usually forget about back correction, right? I mean, you consistently include it.
I'm going to give some examples where. What?
The way around. Right, even though that's not kosher.
Well,
I'm
not saying like, but I mean that you can extend, you know, like, for example, Malassena's calculation to higher orders. It's a correct calculation. So,
no, I'm not saying it's not correct to do the usual thing. I'm just saying that there are cases where it's simpler to do things like that. And I'm going to talk about some cases where it's simpler to do things like that. I'm saying that like it's the same theory. So if you do things properly, you should get the same answer, regardless of the way you calculate.
Yeah. But I understand that you really are doing the correct calculation and just sort of reformulated.
Yeah, I'm just choosing to resume some diagrams and not others. So it's just choosing which part of like which diagrams I'm resuming. That's all I'm doing.
But it's different than what Sterbinsky was doing. Sort of made up the stochastic.
Yes, so that's what's different.
Yeah, okay.
So and my noise, I can actually calculate it from first principle. I'm not just postulating and it's free mass of like free de Sitter space noise and I have no control over like what's how good my approximation is and what are corrections to that. So like everything's under control. So that's the difference. All right, so let's move on to examples where this gives rise to interesting corrections. So the first example I have is hybrid inflation. So hybrid inflation is this two-field model of inflation where I have a valley up here. And I don't know if you can see properly my colors are kind of okay. So like you have a valley here where like the inflaton direction is really flat, but then you have the transversal field, which is called the waterfall field, is very heavy. So the field is constrained to hold, to roll, I mean, at the bottom of the valley. And then that field progressively becomes like lighter and lighter until it becomes tachyonic. And that triggers sort of the fast rolling of the inflaton towards one of the other, or the other of the true minimum of the potential. So basically, that's the picture. Inflation happens up in the valley, and then it ends by the fast rolling of the field. So viewed from above, it looks something like that. So you have inflation happening over here, and then you cross some critical point, and then you roll quickly towards one of the minimum. So that's what hyperinflation is. And if you want to have some explicit example of what the potential looks like, that's what the potential is. So you can just go on and apply that recursion that I was talking about. So step number one, you calculate your free massless, they're just like this sort of noise to zero order. So that's what the answer is. That's the same answer regardless of the model of inflation. So that's sort of a no calculation step. Then you can plug that in the stochastic equation. So you get a set of Langevin equation, which is that, and then you can find their moments. So you can just solve it. So you can find things like, I don't know, the corrected like average inflaton evolution, and then the waterfall field is gonna have zero average, because on average it's gonna stay at the bottom of the valley, but it develops some non-zero dispersion inside the valley. So you can calculate for that, and then you can find what it's sort of what the variance of the inflaton is and what the variance of the waterfall field is. And sort of close to the critical point, it's gonna look like that, its variance. So I'm gonna come back to why this is an important quantity. But basically it's an important quantity because that's the thing that said how long it takes you to roll off the side of the potential at the end of inflation. Okay, so something that would be hard to get in the usual picture is a quantity like that. Because your classical background is just the thing that you would fix would be the thing that stays at the top of the potential, so you'd be expanding around that. And then it would be extremely difficult to characterize like how far away you are, what's the actual background trajectory doing. But using that, you just get it for free. Okay, so then you can go back and use these to set the background on which quantum fluctuations evolve inside of the Hubble horizon. So you replace the occurrences of the coarse grain field by their average to get a representative sort of example of what the background is doing. And so you can expand your linearized mode function equation in terms of the sort of canonically normalized field, and then you get like this. This is sort of the usual thing that you get normally. So you get like the sort of the two, and then the mass term here, and then the metric perturbation here, and then you get the stochastic correction here. That comes from the fact that your waterfall field has developed some standard deviation and is going to sort of act. It really looks like it's renormalizing the mass of the inflaton, basically. And then it's sort of like you can solve this equation in the usual way, so you get sort of the normal answer, except that now the mass of the inflaton looks like it's been renormalized by stochastic effects. And then you can do the same thing for the other field, so similar equation, you get a time-dependent mass, and then once again you get this stochastic correction here that looks like it's changing the mass of the waterfall field. Okay, and then you can solve that in terms of like the standard error function, but it's like super long and messy, so I'm not writing it down. Okay, so then step four, you use those solutions to write the corrected noise, and then you use that noise to source your Langevin equation. And then if you assume that for the waterfall, if I first look at the waterfall field, if you assume that every kick, the PDF behaves sort of quasi-statically in the sense that every time you have a kick, it reaches like quasi-static equilibrium pretty quickly. You can write down an implicit equation for the dispersion of that field. So that implicit equation is what I've written down here. And what I've plotted on this graph is like basically the straight line is just this side of the equation, and the blue line is the other side of the equation. So in the first step of the recursion, the initial guess was here. And after one step of the recursion, I end up here on that graph. And then we said we're in a basin of convergence for this recursion. So eventually, if I keep on going, I'm going to end up like converging towards here. So So that's for just like, this is the dispersion at one fixed time. So if I look at what those dispersions look like at different times, so how do these solutions compare to each other, how close they are to each other, this is what I get. So the black line was my initial guess. The blue one is after one step of the recursion, and the actual solution is the red thing. So I don't know if you can read from the axis, but this is like pretty different. It's like 10 orders of magnitude off. So the initial guess that you had, if you just did what Terbinski did like for the first time, it was completely off. The actual dispersion of the field is much smaller than that at the end of inflation. And this is just because that assumes massless fields, but that field is actually heavy. So of course it's gonna roll down back towards like zero dispersion much quicker. So every time you have a mode that exits, it kicks the dispersion up, but then it rolls back down straight away. But that keeps on happening, so that maintains the dispersion to be some atom equilibrium. That's sort of what's going on here. All right, so that's for the waterfall. And yeah, the reason why this is important, as I mentioned, it's because that's the thing that set how long it takes for the field to roll towards the minimum. And during that instability, you get like, you get basically a large growth of isocurvature perturbations. So if you get a lot of them, they can back react on your curvature perturbations and then spoil your scale invariant spectrum. So that's sort of an important thing to have under control. And the fact that the dispersion is very small means it's going to take a lot longer than you initially thought to roll down. So you have more time to develop those isocurvature perturbations. So it's like so more dangerous to be in that regime. Okay, so if I move on to looking at what the evolution for the anthropon looks like, I can do the same thing. I find my corrected noise, so that's what it looks like. And then I can calculate the spectrum of classical perturbations in my classical theory and look at what the power spectrum looks like and find the tilt of the power spectrum. So that just from here, I just like can read it up from the exponent here. And what I get is something that looks like exactly what I would expect, like usually the same form plus some correction. But actually this mass that appears here is not the mass of the inflaton from the Lagrangian. It's the stochastically corrected mass. So the stochastic effects are really renormalizing the mass of the are we changing the mass of the inflaton? And if you look at some regions of parameter space, how big this is, there are actually some cases, like some regions in parameter space where this is an order one effect. So it's actually really important. And what this does is that it makes the tilt of the inflaton bluer than you thought. So if you thought, so in hybrid inflation, the tilt in the valley is actually always blue. But you could think that you were going to use that potential, like just take off that potential, just use the end mechanism and just glue something that gives you a red spectrum with the same philosophy, but then you always have that blue contribution that you need to be aware of that might flip back around your tilt if you wanted to do that.
This is blowing up as epsilon goes to zero, yes?
Yes, but epsilon cannot be zero because your corresponding radius would be infinite.
Yeah, so well, the normal kind of
So that's a coarse grinding radius. So like if I take epsilon to zero, it means I don't have a classical theory at all. Like I don't have a coarse grain theory because there's nothing, right? That's larger than infinity.
Yeah, this is going the different direction than I thought you said earlier, but keep on going.
So, this is the thing that sets the cutoff. So this is the thing that sets the cutoff of my new effective theory. And corrections are proportional to the log of that cutoff. Right, because my coarse graining theory lives like below the scale of the coarse graining scale. So I cannot take that scale to be zero, because if I was taking that scale to be zero, then I would have no effective theory.
I don't agree with you,
though. Well, like in any case, if you want to, if you're not happy with that, you can just take a smooth cutoff, and then you're going to get an answer that's independent of your cutoff. That's the calculation doing using a sort of a step function. That's why it appears over there. But it's actually like it's fine. Yeah. What was I gonna say? Oh yeah, if you had more fields, like other, say, waterfall fields that were heavy, they would just, it's pretty trivial to generalize how you, like how they would affect the mass of the unicyclone. They would just transform this as the sum of the dispersions. So the more fields you have, the heavier your unicyclone becomes. That's what it means. So sort of, am I running out of time? Kind of. Okay. So yeah, so this, so basically the only point I wanted to make here is that every time you have this type of potential, it always makes the unicyclone heavier because of those extra fields. So if you had like chaotic type models of inflation where the spectrum is actually, the tilt of the spectrum is actually red because the energy density is dominated by the inflaton by another field, then you would get that the tilt becomes redder because it makes the inflaton heavier. So sort of the stochastic effects always make the inflaton heavier. And the more fields you have, the more this is true. So, okay. And then the other class of models where I wanted to talk about, like that I wanted to talk about, are these types of like modulated potentials. This stuff that comes from like sort of axion motivated models. And in those class of models, you have a slower potential that sort of dominates the dynamics of inflation. And then on top of that, you have some small sinusoidal modulation. And then you sort of construct the thing so that this is the thing that dominates, so you don't get stuck in one of those things. So you just roll and then you get some small perturbation on top. So in the usual picture, what happens is that, where's my thing? Okay. So you can, so if you, in the usual picture, if you look at the linearized mode function, what happens is that you get this extra term here. This is for n squared phi squared because I just wanted to have an explicit example. So that's my slower part of my potential. And that's not what you get when you do it from axions, but it's just because it was sort of quick to write down. And then this part here is going to make, for every K mode, you're going to have a regime where you enter resonance. And then that resonance is going to cause particle productions. And so if you look at what happens at the power spectrum, you get an extra modulation on top of the potential. So like in your the CMB power spectrum, you get an extra like cosine term on top due to that particle production. So to see what happens in stochastic inflation with that, instead of replacing the at step three of the recursive method, instead of like picking a representative realization of the background, we're going to keep the full stochastic background. So what that means is that the modes evolving inside the Hubble horizon, they see a fuzzy background. They evolve on a fuzzy background that's fuzzy on the scale of the kick at every time step. So they're never really sure of like where is the inflaton inside the potential. It's sort of jiggling around. And it might be the case that like if you can see that like here, if you make F small enough, and if like the fuzziness of the background is big enough, then you can completely blur out that cos. And then just completely make it look like there's no resonance at all and just kill the resonance. So you can like look, so looking at the dynamics of the sort of zero mode of the inflaton, like the background inflaton, you can find what the, how the frequency scales like. So it scales like this. For like a period of 2 pi is like about that long in the cos. And then you can also look at how fuzzy the coarse grain field is over one period, and it's like that much. So if this is comparable to 2 pi f, then you get that the cos is completely blurred out.
So it's like a response time of the system? Kicking if it has some finite response
time. Every time you receive a kick, right?
Yeah.
So every time you get kicked around, and you have that modulation, so every time you sort of jump around back and forth in the potential, and if the modulation is small compared to that kick, you're never sure where you are inside that kick. So you're never sure, you can never like build the coherent oscillation because you're never like at the same place in the period of the cos. It's just completely, you just pick a random number over the period at every time, basically. That's what it looks like. That's sort of my twiddle argument of why it can become important here, but I'm still working on that, so I don't have any like concrete nice plots yet. So that's another class of examples where it can become linear. And it's sort of the same thing every time you have a sharp feature that's like really small on the scale of the fuzziness of the background. So you have like a, so everything's going to sort of look blurred out in that perspective. All right, so I guess I'm done. So I sort of tried to give some review and motivation for what stochastic inflation is, and I sort of heuristically derived how things work from the equation of motion point of view, a la Starobinsky, and then I've sort of showed how it actually emerges from the path integral, and it's actually something that makes sense and can be perturbatively under control. And then I've applied the recursive method that I proposed to some different classes of model and show that you can get some new results that are not so non-trivial to get otherwise.
So far the focus has mostly been that if you do things this way or the usual way, in both cases the perturbative answer is more or less correct. Both ways get the right answer. It's just that this could be more convenient in some cases. Are there cases where, you know, this basically gets the answer and the other one doesn't because the perturbation theory captures the answer in one
place and
not in the other? Like I was thinking, yes, yeah, this question about it in the internal inflating would be possible with this. Yeah, does one or the other do a better job?
Well, I'm guessing that this standard picture gets it pretty wrong in internal inflation. And in the current state of things, it's actually very difficult to do stochastic inflation in internal inflation, even though it looks like it's the right thing to be doing. Technically, like just numerically, it's difficult. Like, I don't know if you're like familiar with like stochastic processes in finance, but every time you have a stochastic, like the noise becomes a dominant contribution to the stochastic process you're looking at, it becomes really important to know like at what point of the time step the noise is kicking in. If it's at the beginning, in the middle, or at the end, or like at any fraction of the two, the answer sort of starts to strongly depend on that choice, which it shouldn't for a physical process. So it's non-trivial to apply this straight out of like the bath to internal inflation. So there's some, I'm guessing there has to be, like, I'm thinking that there's a way to do it. I just haven't gone around to really think about it and work on that. But it's something that's definitely very interesting to look at.
Or just more generally, do you have other, just some experience, killer applications in mind where one will get the answer sort of really wrong and one will get it right?
Well, you get no dissipation, right, in the standard way of doing inflation. So in cases where you have a lot of dissipation, or if you're interested in things like classicalization and decoherence and the time scale for that, and if you have residual coherence effect in inflation, I don't think that there's a very easy way to do that in the standard picture. But this seems like it's the right formalism to be looking at those questions.
So the noise is always Markovian based on your choice of the function?
No. Actually, there's something I did not mention.
Okay.
But the noise, like, so the noise is Markovian only for that. Yeah. So this one is the only one where the noise is Markovian.
Okay.
These have a non-zero memory, but it's very small on the timescale of the coarse graining. So I've done it for the one loop extension. I haven't looked at like higher loops. But it's actually very small. So you get, it's like of the same size as like the, so the time scale for the memory is about the same size as the time scale for the non-linearity in time, for the non-locality in time. Because every time you coarse grain, you end up with a non-locality in space and in time. And so the size of the memory is about the same size as the non-locality in time that you get. So yeah, you get memory.
Questions? Okay, well, thank you.